From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Marty Moss Cohen, and this is Fresh Air. Milt Hinton helped create jazz history, playing bass with virtually every big name. He also captured that history in pictures. He has a new book of photos and recollections of the greats of jazz. On today's Fresh Air, I talk with Milt Hinton about his music and his photography. Also today, we meet Louis Rukeyser, the man who makes finance not only comprehensible, but downright entertaining. Rukeyser is the host of Public Television's Wall Street Week. And we have reviews of two other offerings on public television and a review of a vintage recording by Earl Hines. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. During the last 60 years, Milt Hinton has been one of the most sought-after bass players in jazz. He played in Cab Calloway's band in the 30s and 40s. During that period, he also performed on many now classic jazz recordings with Lionel Hampton, Billie Holiday, Coleman Hawkins, and Benny Carter. Here's Milt Hinton playing bass on a piece written for him by Art Hodes called Milt Jumps. Hinton has made thousands of concert appearances around the world, touring with Louis Armstrong, Bing Crosby, Pearl Bailey, and performing for the State Department overseas. He's been in demand as a studio musician, recording or performing with virtually every major jazz artist, and also with popular singers such as Barbra Streisand and Frank Sinatra. At all of these performances, Milt Hinton was there with his bass and his camera. He's taken more than 37,000 photographs of jazz musicians. Milt Hinton's photographs and stories have recently been published in a new book, Bassline, which he co-wrote with David Berger. Though his camera is a constant companion nowadays, he wasn't able to take up photography when he was growing up in a poor family in Mississippi.
I never could afford a camera until years later when somebody bought me and gave me a gift of a $25 Argus C3, and I began to take pictures.
Well, you were on the road at the time with Cab Calloway.
Yes, right.
Was a camera a good companion for you?
It was
a good traveling partner.
Yes, it really was. It was a traveling partner. And it just gave me the idea of taking pictures of incidents and places and a musician. All I was interested in was musician because this is who I was around all the time. So I figured we'd take pictures of Shoeberry in Atlanta, Georgia, and take pictures of Cab Calloway in St. Louis, or some incident backstage at such and such theaters, and sort of the flavor of whatever part of the country we were in. And so it grew like that. I decided, well, let me show this musician the way we travel in the bus, hot as heck, you know, the guys in the undershirt sitting in a bus going down through Texas or something like that. On a train, relaxing, most of the guys not in the Pullman, but on another coach, sleeping. And I had took pictures. I made a whole era of taking pictures of guys sleep. And the funny part about one day, they caught me sleeping. Somebody took my camera and took a picture of me when I developed it. There I was.
A little revenge,
yes.
I guess. Well, did they mind you photographing them? Was
no.
Was it intrusive of all on the sort of private life that they had when they weren't performing?
No, we didn't look at it like that. It was mostly a matter of fun. They didn't care about it. I guess several other guys had cameras, but they didn't take it as seriously as I did. And so we just took pictures of each other and places. There was nothing intrusive or nothing insulting about trying to take these sort of pictures. I want to take pictures of guys listening to a playback. If you want to see somebody really being very serious and very deeply concerned, is to catch a musician after he's recorded something and he's listened to the playback. He's so concerned and listening, so deep within himself of listening to every note that he played and how he can improve it if he had to make another take. And the concentration is just beautiful. You can really see that in a photo.
Well, there is a photo you took of Billie Holiday.
Yeah.
And actually listening, I think it was her last recording session.
Right.
And there is this kind of intensity.
Sure.
And the shape of her shoulders and her head is kind of bowed.
Sure.
It's a very strong photo.
Well, yeah. I've gotten a little flack for taking it, but then I've been rewarded because people really realized that this was our last recording session. And she really was not well. And she needed the money. She hadn't been working regularly. She needed the money. And they asked her to do this recording. I guess the people knew that there wasn't much time left. And she agreed. She says, if you can get the guys that used to record me years ago, if you can find some of those fellas, I'd be glad to do it. But we were all there, and it was the music was great. And she just wasn't in a position to sing. Her voice was a little bad. And here you see her after we'd make this record, and she's listening to herself back. And, of course, no photographers were in there because you can't have photographers around when we're recording. Could have a clicking of the camera. But I can wait until the recording is over, the playback is on, see? And then I whip out my camera, and here she is listening so intently to how good the music sounds, and her singing is not what she expects of herself. And some of the shots are just really very sad because there's one shot, I don't think David put it in the book, of her with a, she hears a bad note and she sort of grimaces and you can see a tear coming in a corner of her eye. And one of the pictures shows the music. I didn't even really see that when I took the picture and composing the picture. I was concentrating on her face and how she was reacting. But when I looked at it later, the title of the music was But Not For Me. Mm. So it was these kind of things that I was trying to capture.
Was that your favorite photo that you took? I know you took many thousands.
No, that wasn't really my favorite. It's probably one of the recordings that I think would pinpoints or records a end of an era. But there was another one there that I really took. There was somebody doing a 75, Esquire magazine organized a call for a bunch of musicians to come up in Harlem to do what they call 75 years of jazz. And they inquired about maybe 175 or 100 of the top jazz musicians that were in New York at the time, and they said, well, we come to Harlem to have a composite photo taken. And we all agreed. And we came that morning, 10 o'clock. It was a gloomy morning in Harlem. And 10 o'clock in the morning, not too many people on the street, and it was a side street up there. And here, 75 or 100 musicians that hadn't seen each other for many years, well, all age brackets, from the old guard to some of the avant-garde. And here we were there this morning, and we were shaking hands. Hey, baby, how you doing? I hadn't seen you in such a long time and all this kind of stuff. And this photographer was very seditious. He said, ladies and gentlemen, would you please get up against this brownstone so I can get this picture? Not realizing that these guys hadn't seen one another in a long time, and they just didn't even hear him. You know, they were so busy greeting one another. And I had my camera there. And I was just shooting, and like water seeking its own level, everybody was getting in the little groups, the little personal groups. All the saxophone players were over here greeting one another. The ladies, the vocalists, and the piano players were over there saying, girl, how you been? And the old guard, some of the very old jazz artists were over here talking and giving advice. And I'm photographing. I'm just taking my camera, shooting all these different things. And this man is saying, please, ladies and gentlemen, up against the wall, please. And there was one particular photograph which you asked me about that I really liked. All of the great drummers of one era were there together, and they were so delighted to see one another. And never under the sun would you have seen all of these great drummers in one photograph. And there was a great Joe Jones, Papa Joe Jones, as we call him, from Jonathan Jones, who was Count Basie's famous drummer of era, and he's telling some joke. And there's Gene Krupa, that was Count Basie's drummer, and he's talking to Gene Krupa, who was Benny Goodman's drummer. And there was George Whitland listening to it. George Whitland was Paul Whiteman's great drummer. And there was Sonny Greer standing there, leaning over listening, and that was Duke Ellington's great drummer. And Judy Singleton, the senior of the group, was Louis Armstrong's great drummer from New Orleans, and behind him was Art Blakey. And I snapped this picture, and when I saw it again, I really couldn't really believe what I had. It was just so beautiful to get all of these really great drummers in one picture.
Well, that's the real advantage that you had as an insider. Yeah, I mean, you knew that the picture was going on.
Yeah.
Where the professional, quote unquote,
sure,
photographer,
he didn't know who these guys were. You know, but hey, I'm looking. How are you? Do you ever get these great drummers together again? And now, when you look back at that picture, Joe Jones is gone, Gene Krupa is gone, Sonny Greer is gone, Zooty Singleton is gone. The only drummer left in that picture is Art Blakey. Mm. That's still with us, you know. So these are things that just couldn't be recorded again.
Well, I know that in the foreword to your book, Dan Morgenstern said that as a bassist you were a good listener and that as a photographer you were a good observer.
Yeah, well, that's quite true. Because the word bass means bottom.
Yeah.
Architecturally, it means the lowest part of a building, which has to be strong in order for the building to survive, to stand. And it's the lowest voice in the orchestra, the human voice. And it's a sort of, as we say, a back of the bus instrument. Mm. You have to feel as if you want to support. We're Atlas. You have to have that sort of attitude about yourself and about this instrument and what you're doing is to make other people sound good. We're in the background, but it's important that they have the solid background in order that they might play well. So it's a supportive sort of instrument, and I guess you have to have a certain humility about you to want to make other people look good or sound good.
My guest is legendary bass player Milton Hinton. You were born in Mississippi
Vicksburg, Mississippi.
Yeah, what kind of a place was Vicksburg?
Well, for a black guy like me, it wasn't too easy. It wasn't too good. I don't remember too many bad things about it, except one lynching that I really saw once. It was very exciting and frightening to me.
Well, you were about 7 or 8 years
77
old.
77 years old, yeah. I saw this. And
what did you see?
Well, my uncle had been in an automobile accident, and I had gone to the hospital to see him with my mother's youngest sister, who was just about 4 or 5 years older than I, and she was a sort of chaperoning me because I was about 7 or 8. Coming home, and we saw this mob of people, and we had to go right by this street in order to get to our house. Saw this great mob of people there, and they were carrying on with a lot of noise, and it was gun shooting. And being inquisitive like any little boy would be, I just walked up to it. My aunt was trying to pull me away, and there was this black man hung up on a tree, and they put a drum of gasoline under him, and the fire was burning. He was running like a piece of bacon. But the guy had long been dead because he had been accused of looking in some window or something at somebody undressing.
And what kind of impression did that leave on you?
Well, I couldn't really understand it. I couldn't believe what I'm seeing. It didn't leave me with the impression that this was a human being. It was just a body here. But the sad part, when I got home, my grandmother and all of the black ladies in the neighborhood were getting their children, the boy children, together, and they would put black pepper in the socks of the children.
Why?
And the boys, so that if a dog came to smell him, the dog would go away, so they wouldn't be, in case a dog came and barked or whatever. But if they had black pepper in their socks, a dog wouldn't come near them. This is a kind of a defense that these people, and my grandmother had been a slave when she was a young girl. She had been a slave of Joe Davis, who was Jefferson Davis' father, who was president of the South. So her name was, and she took the name of, at the Emancipation Proclamation, she took the name of her overseer, the man that was over the plantation. His name was Carter. So her name was Hetty Lady Carter Robinson. And she was freed in the time as a girl, and she grew up and married a man named Matt Robinson and had almost 13 children by him. The last child born 5 months after his father was dead. Mm. So this poor lady must have had some time trying to raise these children. A great deal of the children died early in childbirth, early in the life. Only 5 or 6 really survived, of which my mother was one.
You moved to Chicago. I guess you were maybe 10 years old, something like that.
Something like that.
It was your first train ride. And what was Chicago like? I mean, you were a kid coming from Mississippi, from the deep South, and Chicago was quite a town.
Yeah, well, it was quite a shock and quite an experience for us. My mother had preceded me. My mother and my uncles had preceded me to Chicago. They had come ahead of us to make room for, to get some places to stay and get some jobs, because everybody in the South had been hearing about Chicago being very, lots of work for unskilled blacks, because they had the greatest stockyards in the world there at that time, and all of the hotels were there, meeting places of all the hotels and salesmen. Chicago Board of Trade, the great hotels. So there was a great exodus of black people that could get out of the South, the ones that were thinking of better conditions for themselves and for their children.
You talk about some of the people in your high school who went on to fame, and there was someone, I suppose, more infamous in Chicago that you had seen, and that was Al Capone.
Oh, yeah. Well, he was a big influence in Chicago during my early years.
He kind of ran the place, didn't he?
He sort of ran the place. And he ran it on we looked at him more or less as a Robin Hood.
Did you?
We really
did.
I mean,
in spite of his reputation for violence?
In spite of his reputation. Well, there wasn't that much violence. It was a matter of control. Al Capone, it was violence if you didn't go by his rules. But if you went by his rules, example, if he came into a black neighborhood, he hired all black people to take care of the vices and the alcohol and the prostitution. He hired all black people in the neighborhood to take care of. Say, now you run this hotel and you buy your alcohol from me. You buy it from me at $12 a gallon and you sell it at $8 a gallon, at $16. So you make $8 or whatever it is on a gallon. So anyway, this is a way to run around in the neighborhood. But the black people were in charge of it. And I remember...
You used to deliver, didn't you?
After school, my uncle was in charge of this, selling this stuff to the, what we call flats. These are where the houses where people come and have a little party or something, sit around with the ladies. And we delivered alcohol to these people. They bought all that, and people in the neighborhood bought it from us. And my uncle would have me go with him to deliver it. And I got a terrible accident doing that. And
almost lost your hands, right?
Yeah, almost lost my finger. And in fact, it was just almost off in this one accident that I was in. And I was screaming because I was studying violin and playing violin. And the doctor said, well, My everything on my right side was broken, a tremendous scar on my face, and my right arm was broken, my hand was broken, and my finger was just hanging off, you know. And the doctor said, of course, Al Capone heard about it because there was alcohol all over the street, just cans of it. My uncle was out cold. I thought he was dead. He had a lot of money in his pocket, and I picked it up and stuck it in mine. And I got to the hospital. They got me, scooped me up out of the street and got me to the hospital. And this doctor said, well, I can't do anything for this finger. I'll have to cut it off. And Al Capone had heard about this accident, and he came over to see that everything was okay. And the police never said a word about the alcohol in the street. It was just like it was water out there. And he came to the hospital to see how I was coming along, and I was in there screaming when the guy said, you got to cut my finger off. And I said, oh, please don't do that. And he said to this doctor, he says, don't cut his finger off. Don't cut it off. And I have that finger to this very day. And
you have Al Capone to thank for it, right?
I sure do. So he was that kind of a Robin Hood to us in our view. And when he told people, when they really got him for income tax evasion, which is the only way the government could get him, he told me, he says, well, now, I'm serving the people and giving people what they want. If you think that these kind of people, the unskilled labor people that I got working, making $200, $300 a week, when everybody else is making $25 or $30 working at the stockyards, if you think these people are going to go back to working for $25 a week, you're crazy. And, of course, when they stopped it, those people started robbing and bank robbers because they were used to big money and they just wouldn't go back to work. And that's where the whole thing, that's our version of it at least.
My guest is jazz bass player Milt Hinton. For over a decade, he played in Cab Calloway's band, and he's performed with most of the great musicians of jazz. He's also a photographer, and his pictures of jazz musicians have recently been published in a book titled Bassline. We'll talk more after this short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
My guest is jazz bassist Milt Hinton. In the late 30s and throughout the 40s, he played in Cab Calloway's band. Let's listen to him playing with Calloway in a 1938 recording of the song, Hoy Hoy. ¶¶ did you come to play bass? Because you started off with violin.
Oh, yeah. Well, most of the kids in the neighborhood when I was 13 years old, July 18th, 1923, I took my first violin lesson.
You remember the day?
Yeah, I remember the day. It was very, very important to me. And I played the violin in the orchestra. And then 1929, Al Jolson made the first sound movie in 1929, The Jazz Singer. And in all the neighborhoods, there was big orchestras in every theater because they had the silent movies, so they had an orchestra. Matter, it was a small neighborhood. You'd have two or three pieces, a piano and a violin to play for the music on the screen because there was no sound there. But when he made that first movie, The Jazz Singer, there was sound. Every orchestra lost their job because now the sound is on the screen. It's recorded. So all of the neighborhoods, all the violin players all over the United States lost their jobs in the theaters. And especially in this black community of ours, every black violin player lost his job. There was no place. The nightclubs didn't have violins in it. They had trumpets and trombones and saxophones and clarinets, but no violins. So here I was just about prepared to enter this great world of theater, and there was no jobs available. My teachers that were teaching me had no jobs. And Al Capone, again, our Robin Hood, had opened up a club called the Cotton Club on the west side of Chicago in Cicero. And, of course, the Cotton Club meant that you had black entertainment. It wasn't black customers, but the entertainment was all black, girls and boys and orchestra. And I'm prepared. I'm at the stage of age where I'm not ready to go out into the world. And all of my peers from high school that played horns got a job in Al Capone's orchestra, the Cotton Club Orchestra over there. And there we were. My parents were making $25 and $30 a week in the stockyards, working the porters in the railroad stations. And here we are. The guys are making $75 a week, which was astronomical salary. And Capone made it possible for them to get anything they want. The guys would say, look, I need a car. I said, go down there and tell them I said, give you a car. And you can pay $5 a week on a car, something like that. And here I'm delivering newspapers for $9 a week because I'm still playing this violin. I know it's much music, but I don't have it. The thing, I'm playing this violin, and I'm delivering newspapers, and these guys are getting off at 5 o'clock in the morning from these nightclubs, and I'm just beginning to go out with my newspapers, and I would be so embarrassed I would hide. I wouldn't let them see me. They had Ford cars with disc wheels, and that's when I said, heck, I got to get me another instrument. So I thought it was quite easy to come from violin to bass because they're both string instruments, and they both have four strings.
And was it easy? Was that an easy transition for you?
It was the easiest.
I mean, they're four strings, but yeah, it's this.
Well, four, so yeah, they're exactly backwards. The violin is E-A-D-G, and the bass is D-G-A-E. So fourths become fifths on inversions when you study harmony.
Yeah.
If you turn it around, you can count it around, and fourths becomes fifths. So that wasn't too bad of a conversion for me. I was accustomed to strings, even though this was a big one. And I thought I'd try that, and it worked out very well. I kept practicing on it until some old bass player got too drunk to make his engagement.
That's right. He stepped in.
And he said, well, just try this kid tonight. We can't do it better. And I did fairly well, and of course they were satisfied. And the next time the guy got drunk again, they called me until I finally got to the place where I was doing pretty good. And that was the biggest decision of my life, to decide to give up my newspaper route, which I was sure making $9 every week to take a chance on music, because I wasn't too sure it was going to make it, and I was getting $19 for this one job. But it was very sparse. It came once every two, 3 weeks or something like that.
Well, you said, I think, that in your life, the two jobs you've ever had was being a musician
and
delivering
newspapers. Yeah. And I always said I had to try to do better on the music because I didn't want to go back to my newspaper route. And even when Cab Calloway hired me in Chicago, I was working with Zooty Singleton there at the Three Deuces. And then when Cab Calloway came through needing a bass player, and he asked Zooty, I hear the kid's pretty good. And Zooty said, yeah, he's all right. He said, well, can I have him? And Zooty said, yeah, you can have him. He gave me away. He didn't nobody asked me. He just gave me.
Didn't fight over you,
not
right?
Not at all.
Well, you describe really traveling with Cab Calloway. You really went in style. He used to rent two train cars, one baggage.
Right. That's
the
right.
The other a Pullman car, and he would get half.
Sure.
And you guys would travel, I suppose, in the other half.
Yeah.
And he always gave, I think what you said, is a real high-class kind of performance.
He was a disciplinarian. And at that time, he was making a lot of money for the time. And he was a strict disciplinarian. We've all learned so much, and with the few of us that have survived, we try to pattern ourselves or any organization we're with. with the type of thing that Cab Calloway was like, disciplinary and always punctual, on time. You couldn't get any guy, Dizzy Gillespie, any of us, to be late for an engagement because he said, I got to be here, you better be here. Mm. He taught us that cleanliness is next to godliness. He bought 4 or 5 sets of uniforms and already insisted that we keep them clean, that we make an appearance on that stage in proper attire and on time and give your best performance. And he was like that. He traveled in a top class, you know, Pullman car. There were no planes in those days. Whenever possible, we went by. We would keep a Pullman porter for maybe 4 or 5 months.
Just to travel with you and carry bags?
Yeah, we had the same car. And the Pullman porter was in charge of this coach. And we would stop in Atlanta and put it on the side of the track. And then we'd go and make our engagement, come back and get on there and catch up with the next train and go on to the next town. And we had our own Pullman car. And right next to it, he had a huge baggage car in which he had a big Lincoln automobile of his own in there and had a chauffeur. And we all had trunks with our clothes in it. And we could just walk from our Pullman to the baggage car in our pajamas, and when we stepped off the train, we were like stepping out of a bandbox. Everybody was sharp. He was really one of the nicest people to work for, and he always paid well.
Paid vacations.
He was born on Christmas Day, and December 23rd, he would stop work no matter where we were. He would give everybody their salary, and $100 for Christmas. So if you'd been crazy and drank up and gambled up all of your money, Christmas, you could go home with your salary and $100 and a railroad ticket to your hometown. And we always opened on New Year's Eve back at the College Inn in Chicago, and you'd have a ticket back to the College Inn. If you promised that you would be back there for New Year's Eve, you got your gift and your salary and your ticket.
You know, you've been in this jazz business for, gosh, 50 some years.
Yeah.
When you look back on it, how has the scene changed? I mean, how do you think like the health of jazz is nowadays as compared to the times when there were clubs in New York and Chicago and bands like Cab Calloway and Count Basie and Duke Ellington? And
today, I find it a great opportunity now coming back because jazz is a truly an American art form. And when we travel abroad, the world is broadened. We're every place. Well, jazz musicians are like roaches.
You never get rid of them, right?
Never get rid of them. They're all over. They're not making a tremendous living, but they are enjoying a bit more success, especially the ones that have survived or the ones that haven't gotten involved in heavy drugs things, the ones that are still around. People remember them from the records they made or from their big bands. We go to Europe and people highly respect you because we're unique. We are something that didn't come from there.
That's right.
It's like ladies here in America like clothes coming from France and from Italy. And you just admire them. It's wonderful. Now, this is an Italian dress. This is an Italian suit. Or this is a French suit. And so we admire it. Well, the same way the Europeans admire jazz, this is something that's really American. It didn't come from any place in Europe. It was concocted, conceived right here of this society in which we live in.
Milton Hinton, it's been wonderful to talk with you. I thank you very, very much.
Thank you for having me aboard.
My guest has been bassist Milt Hinton. He's played with many of the great artists in jazz, such as Billie Holiday, Dizzy Gillespie, Coleman Hawkins, and Cab Calloway. He's also a photographer, and a new book of his photographs of jazz musicians has just been published by Temple University Press. It's titled Bassline, and it's co-written by David Berger. I'm Marty Moss Cohen, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, we'll feature a live performance and interview with the rock duo Timbuk 3. That's Barbara and Pat McDonald and their boombox that supplies pre-recorded rhythm tracks. They first gained attention for their hit song, The Future's So Bright, I've Gotta Wear Shades. I hope you can join us.
Funding for Fresh Air is provided by a major grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and a grant from Fisher's World Travel Guides. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Marty Moss Cohen, and this is Fresh Air. Terry Gross is on assignment today. Coming up, Louis Rukeyser explains how he tells the financial experts from the charlatans. Rukeyser is the host of Public Television's Wall Street Week. Also, television critic David Bianculli reviews two other public TV shows, Alive from Off-Center and American Masters. Both series begin new seasons this week. And jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews a new reissue of music from the late Earl Hines. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
I'm Dale Willman. The White House announced today it will pay compensation to the families of the 290 people killed in the U.S. attack on Iranian Air Flight 655. However, President Reagan and other officials say no money will be paid to the Iranian government. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
The president, prompted his aides say by humanitarian concerns, made the decision this morning to offer compensation to the relatives of the Iran Air victims. Officials say the offer is being made on a voluntary basis by the U.S. and does not imply the U.S. feels legally liable for the incident. President Reagan stressed today that it is the families and not the Iranian government that will be receiving the funds.
I want to make it plain that there's certainly going to be no compensation for the government of Iran or anything of that kind, because we don't feel that any such thing is called for. But as I've said, I think we all can have compassion for the innocent people who were the victims.
Many details remain to be worked out on the payments, including the dollar amount and how they'll be distributed to the Iranian families. And there's congressional opposition to overcome, with some lawmakers arguing there should be no compensation payments as long as American hostages are being held in Lebanon. I'm Brian Naylor at the White House.
The White House today suggested that President Reagan has chosen a successor to Attorney General Edwin Meese, who will leave office in the next few weeks. Sources say former Pennsylvania Governor Richard Thornburg has been picked to replace Meese. At a briefing, spokesman Marlon Fitzwater said the administration wants to announce the nominee before Congress adjourns Thursday for the Democratic National Convention. The Piper Alpha oil platform fire in the North Sea is continuing to burn, and a slick from the fire is spreading. Now reports suggest that the fire may have been avoided if officials had heeded earlier warnings about gas leaks. NPR's Bill Buesenberg reports.
Investigations are underway to determine exactly what caused the Piper Alpha oil platform to explode in flames. A massive gas leak from the gas compression chamber has been suspected because survivors recalled hearing a piercing whistle or scream as the gas escaped just before the platform blew up. One survivor, an electrician, and the girlfriends of two other men who died in the disaster have said they were aware of reports of gas fumes in the days before the accident. One welder on Piper Alpha, Craig Barkley, told his girlfriend he refused to light his welding torch because of the fumes just 2 days before the disaster. A union official said men finally stopped complaining about the gas because it only got them in trouble with their supervisors, it put their jobs in jeopardy, and because nothing was done about it. Occidental Petroleum Company, which owns the platform, rejected that charge, insisting there were no reports of gas leaks communicated to officials on shore. I'm Bill Buesenberg in London.
Prince Sihanouk, the head of the guerrilla coalition fighting Vietnamese forces in Cambodia, announced today that he was resigning his position and moving to France. U.S. officials, however, say they expect Sihanouk to continue to play a leading role in the search for a Cambodian settlement despite his resignation. The guerrillas are fighting Vietnamese forces, which invaded Cambodia in 1978 and installed a new communist government. Interior Secretary Donald Hadow said today he would recommend a presidential veto for an Interior Department budget bill if the measure includes a ban on offshore oil drilling. Hadow's comments were directed toward the Senate, which is considering a department budget bill that would continue a ban on such drilling. The House has already approved a new moratorium on that drilling. Reagan administration officials began a week of talks today with the Prime Minister of Kuwait. Last week, Congress moved to block a sale of air-to-surface missiles to the Persian Gulf nation. That action will be a primary topic of discussion during this week's talks. This is the first visit to the U.S. by a Kuwaiti leader since 1968. Stock prices were higher on Wall Street today. The Dow Jones Industrials rose just over 5 points to close at 211.13. You're listening to National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead has a review of a 1965 live recording by the late pianist Earl Hines. Hines first attracted national attention in 1928 at the age of 23 when he recorded with Louis Armstrong. Later, Hines led big bands and hired early beboppers like Charlie Parker and Dizzy Gillespie. By the late 50s, though, Hines' popularity had temporarily waned. But Kevin says this new album proves that Hines never lost his fire.
So often, record companies unwittingly conspire to make you think about a specific period in a jazz artist's life. In the last few months, we've been treated to three albums from the final phase of pianist Earl Hines' career, albums that demonstrate his continued vitality as he approached age 60. RCA reissued a spirited 1964 session, Up to Date. New World compiled a selection of excellent 70s solos as Earl Hines plays Duke Ellington. And Columbia has put out a splendid trio and quartet set from 1965, live at the Village Vanguard. The quartet sides feature saxophonist Bud Johnson, who worked with Hines off and on for 40 years. On this album, Johnson plays gruff tenor and a brightly blaring soprano sax. Virtually all the key elements of Earl Hines' mature piano style were in place by 1928, but even four decades later, he was full of surprises. When he was forming his style back in Pittsburgh around 1920, Hines got his left-hand strategies from one local pianist and the right-hand melodic stuff from another. That may help explain why his playing so often sounds like a quizzical dialogue between two musical sensibilities. His scrambling left-hand bass lines pointed the way for bop pianists like Bud Powell and Thelonious Monk. But even in the 1960s, Hines' springy right-hand work echoed older styles like stride and boogie-woogie. With each hand following a different muse, he seemed to look forward and backward at the same time. Here's Earl Hines on Lover Come Back to Me. The only concession to changing fashion Earl Hines made after the early 1930s was to modernize his sense of rhythm, taking his cue from fleetly swinging Kansas City bands like Count Basie's. Hines' bassist on the Vanguard set, in fact, is Kansas City great Gene Ramey. The drummer is Eddie Locke. A highlight of the new live set is a remake of Hines' Cavernism, which he'd recorded in 1934, not long after saxophonist Bud Johnson first joined his band. Here's a taste of the 1934 Cavernism. We'll be right back. Now listen to the same section of the streamlined Village Vanguard version 31 years later. Earl Hines had been written off as a has-been by 1960, but by 1965, he was working his way back into the public ear, thanks to live dates, new records, and a couple of appreciative critics. Still, it's a sign of record industry ambivalence toward Hines in the mid-60s that these live recordings have only now been issued for the first time. Better late than never. Earl Hines live at the Village Vanguard may sound corny to some, but to my ears, it wears as well as any new release this year.
Kevin Whitehead is a regular contributor to Downbeat and Cadence. He reviewed Earl Hines live at the Village Vanguard on the Columbia label. This is Fresh Air. You don't have to be a big spender to be a big fan of public television's Wall Street Week. Every week, 10 million viewers tune in to find out about the state of the economy and to watch Louis Rukeyser, the show's witty and irreverent host. Rukeyser has managed to make the often dry topic of business and finance entertaining. Rukeyser began his career in the newspaper business as an overseas correspondent for the Baltimore Sun. He's been the host of Wall Street Week since it first went on the air in 1970. He's also a big draw on the lecture circuit and editor of a new reference book called Louis Rukeyser's Business Almanac. When we spoke, I asked him about the success of Wall Street Week. He says the show is popular for some deceptively simple reasons.
I can only tell you the three things that I try to do, and then you'll know my secrets and you can do it too.
Oh, great.
First is, you have to speak English. Now that.
Well, what do you mean by that?
You can't use polysyllabic jargon. You can't hide behind the professional-sounding baloney that people use to hide the fact that they don't really know what they're talking about. Also, to intimidate other people. Doctors are wonderful at that, as well as economists.
And politicians, I guess we should add.
Sure, the gobbledygook of the trade. So you got to speak in something resembling the English language. Second, having spoken in English, there's a high probability that many people will understand what you said. Therefore, it's helpful if you have some knowledge of what you're talking about. We have now, with those two rules, eliminated virtually everything on the air. But you go to number three, which is you've got to do it with a little bit of flair.
Well, you seem to have a kind of bemused approach to money and to finances, to the economy. And I suppose it's easy to have a bemused approach to someone else's money. But do you have that also for your own?
I always try and figure that it's just your money, not your life. I have a respect for money. Don't misunderstand me. I don't think that money should be denigrated. I think much of the recent talk about greed in the U.S. has been greatly overdone. It's usually somebody else's emotion we're talking about. I find that most people individually can justify their own personal self-advancement. It's just the other guy who wants more than he should have. But I don't think that money's everything, and I don't think that to know about money equates with being obsessed with money. And I think the best way to keep money in perspective is to have some, manage it intelligently, and then go on to the next thing.
What do you think makes a good guest on your particular show? And I would think in certain ways that because of the power of business, that rather than speaking to an audience, that the guests are either speaking to each other or speaking to each other's companies or in some way trying to create some kind of financial environment that they can then take advantage of.
Well, it depends on the guest. Many of them do have that instinct. We really have four different kinds of guests, and they each have their own motives and their own usefulness to our audience. The first is kind of the obvious one, the Secretary of the Treasury, the Nobel Prize winner. It doesn't take a genius to know that our audience is going to be interested in this person. The second is money managers or advisors of great reputation or great achievement. And in the former case, we try and audit them. And in the second case, we try and learn something from them. The third is your nuts and bolts show. We do about one a month like that. And the producer and I will talk, and we'll decide which group we're going to do, and then his job is to find the best person on hotel and restaurant companies in America. The fourth is mavericks and critics, people who say the wheel is rigged, the earth is flat, the game's not fair. And we have great shows with those people, too. Many people, of course, overlap categories. One famous newsletter writer who heard me say something like this once said, to me afterwards, said, "Lou, I was kind of a nuts and bolts guest, wasn't I?" And I said, "I would regard you as a bolt."
But you must get some nuts too, right? I mean, that's in part
plenty of nuts
make the show interesting.
Interestingly, in terms of the guests and in terms of money generally, the most reliable are usually the ones who have a little humility. The ones who are the best heavy hitters over the years are really essentially modest people. They're the first to tell you that they make mistakes, they pick stocks that go down, they judge markets wrong, but that they have certain principles they try and stick with, and that seems to give them a pretty good batting average. On the other hand, when some hotshot flash comes along and tells you he has called the last 43 turns of every market in the world, you know instantly you're dealing with a charlatan.
I know that you've had many awards, and several that rather interested me, and I suppose I'm not sure I would call these awards, but I think it was Playboy magazine called you a rakish raconteur, and People magazine said that I think it was in a dismal business that you were the one and only sex symbol. And I'm wondering how you wear those accolades.
I think they're a giggle, and so do my three daughters. The Playboy thing was kind of funny. They've now done several pieces on me, including the main interview last year, and then about 5 years before that, what they call 20 Questions, which is their secondary interview. And for that one, they illustrated with one full-page color photograph. And the photo they had of me was of me sitting in the pool reading the Wall Street Journal. And after he'd taken it, the photographer said to me, "Lou, you don't know how good this picture is." I said, "What do you mean?" He says, "The way you're holding the paper, no one will ever know whether or not you have a stitch on underneath." He said, "You've just done a parody of every picture that ever appeared in Playboy magazine." So I said, "Well, I've read the magazine. I know what I say at this point. I say, I'm an Aquarius. I can't stand phonies. I hope someday very much to be a nurse. And my idea of a perfect evening is to curl up on a shag rug with that certain someone."
Well, how much of looking and understanding the economy is art, and how much is science?
There's a little bit of both, but it's still an art. There is some science. I think it's important to know the facts, to know what's going on, to have some sense of where the economy is heading in this country. But beyond that, the day-to-day act of investing has to be an art. And those who try and make it a science are forever being frustrated. Some of the best so-called technical market analysts, the fellows who really try and make a science out of it, feel frustrated because they can't quite find that one last indicator that would make it a science. And the reason they can't is the same reason that economists generally miss fire so often in their forecast for the economy, which is we're talking about hundreds of millions of human beings.
That's right.
And human beings do not always do what the graphs and charts and the mathematicians say they should do. I think that's kind of wonderful.
Well, you're talking about human beings and their money.
Yes.
mean, it's a loaded proposition.
Well, in Wall Street, the emotions, of course, the key human emotions are fear and greed. They're forever in conflict. Greed to get a little more money, fear that if you don't cash in now, you're going to lose it all. And in the ongoing battle, interestingly, despite all the recent obsession in our movies and elsewhere with so-called greed, I think fear is the stronger emotion. We saw that again last October, where we had what is generally referred to as the crash. I prefer to call it the one-day nervous breakdown. And
there's a difference?
Oh, yes, because if I had come to you on your program 9 months ago, right after Wall Street fell 508 points in one day, and said to you, "Marty, 9 months from now, the economy, if anything, will be in better shape than it is now. There'll be more people working. Corporate profits will be up, not down. Not only will we not be in a depression, but the unemployment rate will be the lowest in 14 years. The trade deficit will be moving down. You'd probably have said, who invited this loon, and what kind of a Pollyanna am I talking to this morning? But I think there are innate strengths to this economy, to the American people generally. This country is still a land blessed with natural resources, including the people. And I have a feeling that we're not just going to endure, but that we're going to prosper. I think we're beginning to get a little more sensible. 20 years ago, I came back from overseas, and I've been covering economics now nonstop for 20 years. And at that point, the country was anti-business. Certainly, the intellectual atmosphere, corporate was a dirty word. Profits were obscene. Daddy was a rotten fascist materialist. And besides, where's the check for my stereo? And then in the '70s, we found out that if you ignore business, if you spend all your time attacking it, if your only patron saint is Ralph Nader, that you will hurt business. You will indeed impede business progress, but it won't help the average guy. Because as business profits go down, as the country goes into repeated recessions, unemployment goes up, living standards go down. So in the 80s, I think we've muddled through ideologically to a little less ideology, a little more realism. I think that the country now doesn't want to hear what's liberal or conservative, wants to hear what works. And that, I think, is the beginning of economic wisdom. I don't think we have solved all our problems. I don't think the 90s are going to be a glorious problem-free era in America. But I think there is every reason to believe, with the demographic changes we've talked about, with more women in the workforce for a longer time, with some of these other things that we talk about in the book, that the country not only will be as good in the 90s, but will be a more prosperous economy.
Well, Louis Rukeyser, thank you very much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
Louis Rukeyser is the host of Public Television's Wall Street Week and editor of a new book, Louis Rukeyser's Business Almanac, published by Simon & Schuster. This is Fresh Air. You can hear complete coverage of the day's news on All Things Considered. Let's check in with co-host Renee Montaigne. Hi, Renee. What do you have for us today?
Well, our lead story tonight is that there has been a terrorist attack in Greece. It's the second in 2 weeks. Gunmen opened fire on a day cruise ship, killing 3 people and injuring others. And we'll have details later tonight. Also, President Reagan said today that the U.S. will compensate families of those who died in the downing of Iran Air Flight 655. We'll have an interview with a former professor of philosophy who chucked it all to become a private detective in San Francisco. And our pick of the week today from artist Robert Longo on the music he listens to while he's producing art that's on the cutting edge. He sees his job as hotwiring the culture, he says.
Thanks, Renee. Those stories and more coming up from All Things Considered. Two different anthology series are returning this week to public television, one showcasing avant-garde video art and the other featuring independent documentaries on famous American cultural figures. Television critic David Bianculli has a review.
Summertime on PBS used to be full of reruns, just like summertime on the commercial networks. But Alive from Off-Center, starting its fourth season this week, changed all that. PBS put it on in July back then because it didn't know what else to do with a show that strange. When a lot more people showed up than PBS had anticipated, the network realized it had tapped a whole new summertime audience. Before too long, Alive from Off-Center had another summer series as company, American Masters, which begins its third season this week. American Masters is a series of separate programs devoted to an artist's life and work. Most of them are excellent. Some, like the ones on Buster Keaton and the gang at the Algonquin Roundtable, have been documentary masterpieces. This season's opener, on legendary film actress Lillian Gish, is more of an oral history. She does all the talking, except for a few chunks of narration, and we're shown clips from her best performances, most of them in silent movies. Here, for example, she brings real tension to the role of a potential murder victim in D.W. Griffith's 1912 film, An Unseen Enemy. Okay, so maybe silent movies don't translate that well on radio, but they're great to look at, and Terry Sanders, the director of this documentary, does capture Gish's amazing energy. Amazing for anyone, much less someone whose first acting job was in 1902. The show also includes a few of her best stories.
In 1925, I went out to work for MGM, and Mr. Louis B. Mayer said he wanted to meet the girl who started him on his way to fame and fortune. And I thought, boy, I never met him before. What did I ever do? He said, I pawned everything I owned, including my wife's wedding ring, to get The Birth of a Nation for my little theater up in New England. I made so much money, I got the rights for the state, and then I made so much money. That began the fortunes of Zukor, of Louis B. Mayer, all the people, Lemley, Fox, everybody, in films.
Over on Alive from Off Center, things are bizarre as usual, but a lot of the art and artists that were on the cutting edge in 1984, when this show premiered, are almost mainstream now. Spalding Gray, Laurie Anderson, and David Byrne, who even made the cover of Time magazine. This week's season premiere shows just how much video art has shifted from off-center to the dead center of mass media. There are two pieces in the premiere show. The first one is a wild, dizzy look at the world of advertising through the eyes of a freelance artist. It's called Bite and Smile, and it would be impossible to describe except for the fact that the effects are very similar to the ones used on Pee-wee's Playhouse. It's not coincidental either. Pee-wee was originally produced by Broadcast Arts, the company behind Bite and Smile. And the other offering this week is director Julian Temple's contribution to Aria, the big-budget motion picture in which different directors provide visual interpretations of recordings from different operas. Temple uses Buck Henry, Beverly D'Angelo, Anita Morris, and an Elvis lookalike to flesh out a chunk from Verdi's Rigoletto. Here's a sample.
Ormai non sentesi felice appieno chi su quel seno non viva amore la donna e notti qua più bel vento muta da cielo.
I know, that doesn't work on radio either. Sometimes, if you want to get the most out of a TV show, you actually have to watch it while you're watching it.
David Bianculli is television critic for the New York Post. Here's a look at tomorrow's Fresh Air. On our next show, we'll hear from novelist Hilma Wulitzer. She's been praised for her insight into suburban family life and for her portrayals of people who abandon their dreams for the sake of domestic ease. Rock historian Ed Ward will profile Billy Ward and the Dominoes, a group that launched rock talents like Jackie Wilson and Clyde McFadder. And book critic John Leonard will review Muriel Spark's new novel, A Far Cry from Kensington. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who makes Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Production assistants from Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton. Our engineer is Audrey Voblaitis. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. Our theme music is composed and performed by Jackie Byard. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.